No, it didn't come in the mail, I'm sorry. What I was looking for.
You don't need the overhead?
No.
Okay.
Would've been nice, but didn't drive. I sent some things a week ago, Monday. They're not here yet, unfortunately. And if they come during the course of this week, I'll pass out some material to you. Well, we're starting, this is our third chance to converse. And I'm Norman Barth, and the issue today is international debt. And I think I have 1,300,000,000 or 300 billion up on the board, but I'm not sure, because it's a number that's so large that my bank account doesn't go up that high, unfortunately. But third world debt. Why do I select this as an issue to be examined? Well, I think one reason, and an important reason, is because Lutheran World Relief is in the game of development. We're trying to do something to help countries develop. And this, among many other items, is one of the biggest hurdles and one of the biggest drawbacks and things that are holding development in check is the international debt problem. I also consider it an issue because it's upon, in large sense, it's upon the resolution of this problem that the economic well-being of not only the third world, but of the North, including the United States, hinges. And while in one of our earlier conversations we were talking about the difficulty for us who are the non-poor to understand what it is to be poor, we Americans surely, I think, are able to understand debt. For we are the largest debtor country in the world now, which is a new phenomenon for us. So surely we know what debt is. And it's if we are unable, as I said in one of our earlier chats, if we're unable to export our goods to other nations because they are crushed by the weight of debt, our own economic vitality will be diminished. And at the same time, I think we as Christians and as churches must be concerned with the problem that presses people further and further into debt, into poverty. It increases their hunger. It decreases their educational opportunities. It shortens their lives and increases infant mortality. It does this because as funds for schools and medical clinics, agricultural extension services diminish because they have to pay off the debt. Obviously, this impacts upon people. And when I was looking at this problem of the international debt, I couldn't help remember a scene from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, where the Queen and Alice were running. Do you remember it? Let me just read part of it. They were running hand in hand, and the Queen went so fast that it was all Alice could do to keep up with her. And still the Queen kept crying, "Faster, faster." But the most curious part of the whole thing was that however fast they went, they never seemed to pass anything. "In our country," said Alice, "you generally get to somewhere else if you ran very fast for as long as we've been running." "A slow sort of country," said the Queen. "Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast." Well, that's what the World Bank reports in its recent issue. The fact that the outstanding debt of third world countries has doubled since 1982. and that the interest payments are a third higher than they were in 1982. And yet, it also reports that the indebted countries are no better off than they were in 1982. Faster, faster. The Queen was right. You got to run at least twice as fast if you want to get somewhere else. Borrowing from external sources isn't anything new. Our own growth after World War I, or up to World War I, was really fueled by loans from European lenders. Evidence of this is in the Chicago area where I grew up. The Chicago Northwestern Railroad, when I was a boy anyhow, ran on the wrong side of the street, so to speak. The trains ran like they would in England, and like the cars drive in England, on the wrong side. Why? Because the Chicago Northwestern was owned by a British organization and was started with funds from Great Britain. I don't know if the Chicago Northwestern still does it, but nevertheless, that's what happened back in those days. But you see, what really becomes a problem is when external borrowing begins to outstrip a nation's debt capacity or ability to cover or carry the debt. Now, we here in the United States have not reached that level, not yet. And there are several reasons for this. Whatever the reason may be, such as mismanagement or the financing of imports, imported goods for the country's high-income elite, or the squandering by high government officials, of which there are ample examples today, for example, Marcos, in the Philippines, our friend in Zaire, Maputo, who's got 11 palaces spread throughout Zaire, and with four-lane highways going to those palaces, where he's built airfields in the middle of the jungle so he could get into Kinshasa from his one of his 11 palaces, the fact that he's got billions of dollars in Swiss banks. The result is the same, that debt increases. In the years, let me just get a few figures here, in 1970, debt by third world countries, and this is all in billions, $66 billion. Huh? In 74, that jumped to $162 billion. In 82, that jumped to $560 billion. In 88, it's $1.3 trillion. These are all billions. Let me just read from a letter. We have a post, we have a position in Khartoum, Sudan. And Todd Stowell, who is our man in Sudan, is an interesting gentleman, but among his many attributes is his ability to write. Just listen to what he says, and this is unsolicited, but he's out there trying to do something in Sudan with the budget we give him, and trying to do some development work way out in Western Sudan in an area called Darfur. The African debt. Its effect on development activities. This is a very interesting question about the impact of African debt on development activities in Africa and by extension to the third world in general. Sudan is a graphic example of the debilitating effect of debt on a poor country. Sudan's debt is estimated to be about $12 billion, which imposes a very heavy burden on a nation that can barely feed itself, and the consequences from this debt are reflected throughout all levels of society. At the macro level, the debt has created a very real situation, which is causing Sudan to slowly bleed away. Sudan has a negative economic growth for the past 5 years, despite large infusions of new loans and refinancing. The debt service amounts to about $750 million per year for interest only. This amount is more than 100% of Sudan's foreign earnings for a year. In addition, Sudan produces very few things locally, and it is self-sufficient in almost no essential product or commodity. Consequently, Sudan must import almost all essentials and pay for them in scarce foreign currency. In addition, the Sudanese pound has been devalued by more than 3,000% over the past 13 years, which is almost equal to the expansion of the Sudanese debt. The IMF, International Monetary Fund, is pressuring Sudan to implement strict economic controls, impose austerity policies, devalue the currency again, and greatly reduce the outflow of capital by severely restricting imports. Regardless of the social and political consequences. Few products are available in the local market and at escalating prices. This has a tremendous impact on development activities by greatly increasing the cost of operation and procurement, and makes budgeting a very inexact, unpredictable process. One of the things we're concerned about as an organization is, how big a bang do we get out of our buck in your country? And why should we be in Sudan, where we have to pay exorbitant prices for fuel and tires and batteries and tools and equipment that we may need, when we can go to another country and achieve for half that cost twice as much? I'll read a little more from Todd. And as I say, this was unsolicited, but it's getting to Todd, and the fact is that he's being concerned by being unable to do what he's charged to do. There are many reasons why international debt of many countries got out of hand. But in my opinion, there are two significant events which took place in 1969. One in 1969 and the second in 1981. In 1969, an $80 million loan was made by a consortium of US banks to Iran. But the interesting thing is that this particular loan had a new wrinkle. It had a flexible interest rate. Now, we all know what that is. If you go out and buy a house, you try and get a fixed rate of, say, 10%. There was a period of time, maybe 8-9 years ago, when you could only buy a house if you were ready to have a flexible, because the rate of money was going up, and so they said, well, this year you can pay 10, but if it goes up, the cost of money goes up, next year you'll have to pay maybe 12, 14. I remember when I moved from Washington to New York, I had to, in order to borrow money for my house, I had to pay 15.5%. Today, that interest rate, I saw the prime rate just went down the other day, it's down around 11. So in 1969, a new wrinkle, a flexible interest. In 81, commercial banks replaced governments as the prime lenders. Now the the material I had hoped would have been here by now, would have indicated that most of the money that South America owes is owed to commercial banks. Most of the money that sub-Sahara Africa countries owe is owed to governments. And that's a big difference. You know, after World War I, the United States had lent a lot of money to many European countries. And if my history is correct, there was only one that repaid us, and that was Finland. But England and France and all the other allied countries never repaid us. And we finally just scratched it off the book as uncollectible, as a bad debt. Last July, I wrote to President Reagan advocating that we do the same with the money owed to us by sub-Saharan African states. You will recall last year there was a meeting in Toronto of the Big Seven economic states, and many of them, including France and Canada, finally just told their debtor countries, forget it, we're wiping the slate clear, you don't longer owe us any money. And that was the position I took with Reagan, that we should do the same. That it would affect us, of course, as taxpayers, because that money would have to be somehow compensated. But it wouldn't be like the commercial bank down at the corner who had a piece of Latin America debt on its book. There wouldn't be any possibility of the United States going bankrupt, so to speak, and going out of business, whereas if these small and sometimes not so small, Chase National, Hanover Trust, and so on, if they had canceled out, they could bring a real problem in the banking world. And since 1984, it's interesting, since 1984, the net transfer, and by that I mean net transfer, the money that flows either from me to you or you to me, huh, had always been a plus from north to south. North to south. We in the north were always sending more money to the south than they were repaying us in terms of interest or repayment and loan. But then not a strange thing, we should have expected it. Here you go, plus, and you want all these pluses until 1982, when it went $10 billion in the minus. They were now sending us $10 billion more than we sent them. In 1984, that figure jumped to $23 billion. 1987, that figure jumped to $38.1 billion. In 1988, that figure is $43 billion. In other words, the South is sending more money to us than we are to them. And yet, we in the North like to think that it's the other way around. And someone has said, as I said yesterday, that three people in the South go hungry so that someone in the North can have an overweight problem. The North, you see, has discovered, in my opinion, how to squeeze blood not from a turnip, but from a coconut, a coffee bean, sisal plant, uranium, or other products of the third world. Faster, faster, shouted the Queen.
Excuse me, did you get a response from Reagan?
Yes, I did a very technical response written by someone in the Treasury Department, of course, which went on to tell me how much they were doing in third world area, helping third world countries, but really didn't answer the problem. I might say I have just recently, in the last month or so, written to the Secretary of Treasury, Brady, to congratulate him for coming out with the, what is known as the Brady Initiative, which is at least looking at the possibility of reducing debt owed to us by African countries. I think it's important that you can't always kick the guy in the pants. You got to occasionally pat him on the back if you want to get some kind of results. What do all these statistics mean for the hungry? And that is why it's a problem. And I might say before I go into that, and I'm sorry I didn't bring along some things I had in my office, but you would remember not too many months ago, I would guess in March, you read in your local paper about riots in Venezuela. What were they? Well, the government had increased the price of some commodities, fuel, bread, some other products, and the people were protesting this cost, because when you increase the cost of fuel, that means the cost of getting on a bus is going to increase because it costs more to operate the bus. And there were hundreds of people who were killed. And not many years ago, we had the same thing in the Dominican Republic. We had them in Haiti. You have them in Brazil. This is when the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, part of the World Bank system, tries to impose upon debtor countries strict economic terms to deal with their debt problem. And usually it means increasing prices. So people buy less. Yeah, but that means the prices go up and people can't even buy what they want. Rather than the rich feeding the poor, when you see this kind of statistic, it's the poor that are feeding the rich. What does this impact upon? Let me just read according to UNICEF. In its State of the World's Children for 1989 said, it's the poor who suffer the most. It's the poor who spend most of their income on basic necessities of life, food, water, housing, bus fares. And the second reason they suffer the most is they also, if I can get the next page, they also have the least political muscle to ward off the blow of recession. When things become financially tight in a nation's budget, the services most radically cut are health services, schooling, food and fuel subsidies, and services upon which the poor are the most dependent. You see, then there is no money left to invest in the building blocks of development, and that is people, human resources.
No. What things is the money continually poured into then? Are we talking the military is what's upheld while these other things are being cut? When money is tight, what are the main things that the governments want to keep strong?
Their military, their national airline. I mean, what does Uganda need a national airline for? Seriously. Well, I'll tell you, they need it for national prestige, even though they can't afford it. Zaire has a national airline. It's got two or three airplanes. Most of the time they're down, and when they're not down, they're being, not confiscated, but being...
cannibalized.
Well, but for Maputo's own personal travel, conscripted, huh, for his own travel. Huh? They surely want to keep those things. And they want to keep, of course, their own gravy that they take off of the top by the elites. And no money, therefore, is available to invest in what I call human capital. This means that the cost is upon the back of future generations. Former Tanzanian President Julius Nyerere asked, "Must we starve our children to pay our debt?" The question has now been answered in practice, and the answer is yes. Thousands of children have paid with their lives, according to UNICEF, and are still playing with their malnourished bodies and minds. UNICEF's report states that in the impoverished northeast part of Brazil, infant death rates increased by 25% in 84 and 83, the result of economic recession. Several years ago, I was at an international debt meeting in Washington, D.C., where former Chancellor of Germany, Helmut Schmidt, spoke. And he said quite bluntly that the debt of the Third World must be forgiven. It isn't economically practical, he said, to pay it off. It'll never be paid off. A pamphlet that I had hoped would have been here by now, put out by Interfaith Hunger Appeal, of part of which LWR is a member, it is evident to all who in the world who wants to see it that the international financial system is devastating to developing countries. The link between debt and environment and hunger becomes stronger as indebted countries, in order to earn foreign exchange, turn to cash cropping, rather, which pushes peasants off the best land in order to grow cash crops, cotton, peanut oil, peanuts, tobacco, coffee, that they can sell to us. And so they want the best land for these crops, and therefore they push the peasant off to marginal land, and then he's working land that shouldn't be worked, and the environment becomes destroyed. And the queen shouts faster, faster. Holly?
Say that we did forgive all third world debt. Would there be any way that we could ensure that these governments wouldn't just take that money that they're now no longer having to pay back and put it into more airplanes and more gravy and things like that?
We certainly can. We certainly could try. We certainly cause them to do other things sometimes. But you know, the problem is, for example, take Marcos. USAID, the aid organization of the United States government, knew very well, everybody did, that Marcos was taking money right off the top. That was no secret. But we wanted to keep Marcos on our side because of the bases there at Subic Bay and Clark Air Force Base. And so we turned our head the other way and didn't look at this. Why isn't it possible to say, hey, wait a while, we're not going to permit this, and cause the government to change its view and say, look for someone else. We and embassies around the world know the party in power as well as people who are out of power. I'm not saying we overthrow governments, don't get me wrong, but I think we can say, well, we're going to have to stop the aid. Or you give aid to Lutheran World Reliefs, and I use that in the generic sense, to the Catholic Relief Service, to Church World Service, to organizations that are at the grassroots level and not at the governmental level. And you say, we're not going to put any more money in at the government level. We're going to do it through private voluntary organizations who are working with private voluntary organizations who are Filipinos, who are Ethiopians or Sudanese or Mozambicans or whoever they are. I think they can do that. We caused them to change policies. We're trying to cause now South Africa to change its policy through economic pressure, economic sanctions. If we want to cause that change, why can't we bring about pressure on the other side?
Another, if you know, what if we did forgive all the debt, all the countries who are debtors, forgave all those debts, then what happens? They know that they're going to have to borrow again. You start the cycle again. What happens then? Yeah. If they are forgiven, all those.
Well, for one thing, you eliminate that.
Yeah, I understand that.
And that, just think what you can do with $43 billion. You do it on different terms. You don't have a flexible increase. You see, in a way, providing money to them can be in our best interest. I guess that's my point. Yeah, and then you would maybe work with them, and maybe you'd let me just say here, the United States is the major victim of cuts in imports by 17 most heavily indebted countries between 81 and 86. These countries reduced imports by $72 billion. That's a lot. Because they can't afford to pay. There's the Overseas Development Corporation, a think tank in Washington, has come out with a little booklet talking about third world strategies and the fact that we have to start being concerned about selling to third world countries because they are the largest share of the countries in the world. In order for our own economic well-being. And I think they're right when you see that in just 5 years we lost $72 billion, and we wonder why that trade balance is that way. Yesterday I brought to your attention the fact that look at Korea. South Korea used to be a very poor country. Today they're exporting Hyundai or whatever they are, cars to us and all kinds of things to us. What?
Reeboks,
yeah, that's right. Why? Because, they're industrious people, for one thing, but also the terms of trade are such that, they're producing things better than we are able to make.
Norman, is the United States still the chief force in the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank? Are we still a controlling force, or has that changed?
That's changed.
Who is?
We may be in, we may be in real and close technical terms, but I think that's that is being now dispersed to the big seven, to Japan, Germany, West Germany, Great Britain, France, Italy, Canada, so that it's more evenly diffused than it was before. At one time, we were the top. Yeah. But that isn't so anymore, and I just know it's very close.
Is that good or bad, in terms of this whole international?
Well, I'm sure you'll get people who discuss either side of that question, but I guess, I don't know. I would have to take a look at that. I just don't know. But I think that these are some of the problems we have. I would guess it's a good thing myself. I think we've been too powerful. And I guess I would say it would be a good thing. Let me read a little more from Todd's letter. Government services and programs are even more severely impacted and are virtually crippled by this local scarcity and an absence of foreign exchange or access to foreign sources of supply. In particular, essential services such as public health, agriculture, water, education, and public works are virtually non-functional due to the lack of all necessary products. There, and then there is the element of corruption in the debt crises. The loans and grants which do come into the country must come through a government and an economy dominated by the elite, who have all the wealth, power, and position in the society. These elite frequently divert these incoming funds into foreign bank accounts or use them in the black market activities to make enormous profits from a scarcity which they create. They create, they legislate, and manipulate. It is estimated that up to 50% of the Sudan debt has been misappropriated and funneled out of the country. There are more Mercedes in Khartoum than in New York, and yet this country has a per capita income of a few hundred dollars per year. Thus, the people of Sudan reap few benefits from the debt, which does not create the intended development and economic growth. But the Sudan will be repaying this loan for decades to come. Needless to say, the debt is a major contributing factor in the poverty and economic decline common throughout Africa. As a solution, I propose, and he comes up with a different solution than I do, I propose that the debt not be forgiven, but rather set aside and removed from current accounts. Many countries, such as Sudan, would earn surpluses if they did not have to pay the interest on their debt. When these countries have built up a certain amount of foreign currency reserve, say $2 billion, they then could repay the loan from their accumulated reserves. Keeping this debt on the books and demanding repayment will force these nations to run perpetually in the red and sink ever further into the debt trap. I think it's also essential that donors begin to demand accountability and responsibility in regard to any new loans or grants. That's what Holly was saying. Otherwise, the elites will continue to devour the incoming monies, and the economic conditions in these countries will stagnate and even decline.
What is the resource? This, please don't take this wrong. What is the resource in Sudan that makes it, aside from a Christian standpoint, logical to invest in Sudan? What have they got? Have they got land that will produce food? Have they got resources? Or do they just have people who might be able to assemble things as Korea and Taiwan have?
No.
Just as an example of other situations.
Well, and Sudan is right here, huh? It's broken into two parts, and Sudan is a real basket case today. First of all, it's got about 20 million people. This area here the Great Lakes, Mississippi River, that area there is equivalent to everything east of the Mississippi in the United States. 20 million people. Can you imagine building a road from Miami to International Falls, Minnesota, with a tax base of 20 million people, and a tax base that where most of these people are poor? So Sudan has got fewer miles of paved road than the state of Rhode Island. It's got fewer paved roads than the city of Washington, D.C. What do they have, you asked? Country is really divided in two parts. Up in the north are the Arabs, Muslims, and in the south Are the black people Christians or animists? And down in here, in the Nile province, is a very wealthy, a very good deposit of oil. And so they've got that. This here area, if you ever flown out of Khartoum and gone up the Nile River, you'll see and the Nile, you know, starts down here, and then the Blue Nile comes, and they both meet here in Khartoum, the Blue and White Nile. When I came across from Port Sudan down to Khartoum, takes 17 hours by car on one of the few paved roads in the country. But it's one of the world's greatest sandboxes. I mean, you know, it's just great. Kids would have fun there. Just miles and miles of sand and camels and stuff like that. But the point is, it's very fertile. And as you go up past the Aswan Dam, you know, this whole valley is a ribbon of green as you fly over it. And the Nile is there. Down along here, where the Blue Nile comes in, this part of Sudan is also very wealthy. Sudan last year had a surplus of 5 million tons of sorghum. And Dura. Dura is another, spell with one R or two R's, either way. So they've got a lot of wealth, but they are underpopulated, I would say. You know, people are always worried about population. Here it is, equal size, 20 million people. One of the problems with Sudan, of course, is this Arab North, Black South, Muslim North, Christian Animist South, poor North, wealthy South. And the South, what the North wants to do, and they've got the control, they want to take that oil out, pipe it up to Port Sudan, and there refine it. And then the South, you see, wouldn't see any result of any economic growth. So the South is fighting. As you know, right now there's more of the civil war that went on down there. And it's between South and the North. It's economic, it's racial, it's religious, it's everything you can think about. Yeah, the Sudan could be a very wealthy country. We see it as militarily important because you got Libya over here. Mm-hmm. And the Libyan influence is growing upon the Sudan. Well, I didn't mean to go into that.
Isn't there even kind of a planned genocide of the North against the South?
I should say there is. In fact, the Dinkas and the Nuer people, I think that's how you spell it, are in the South, and they've been cut to 300,000 people. One of the fellows in my office was in Sudan about 2.5 months ago. He's told by people that you won't find anybody under 2 years old in the southern Sudan because hunger, starvation kill the young and the old. And what does that mean? It means and they're out to kill, the Muslim North are out to kill these two tribes. And that means not only do you genocide, but you're killing off a culture, a society. They're going to have to be retaught what Dinkas and, you know, what their culture is, what their background is. The Nuer people and the Dinkas, if you follow basketball, the Washington Bullets have got a fella from Sudan, Bo is his name.
He's from San Francisco now.
Is he with San Francisco? 7'4" is he?
Yes.
He's a Dinka, huh? They're the kind of people that stand around like this with a stick, huh? Because they see storks do that. And storks do that, and they sit there, and they'll stand there for hours with a stick in their hand, and that's how they rest. Quite interesting. Well, the debt problem is a problem that I think must be resolved. I had some little quotes that maybe I haven't covered, and maybe I have.
One other question about
yep.
that. Now, when you work in the Sudan, do you try to funnel supplies into the south, or do you have to do it through the north?
Well, you have to come through Port
Sudan, first of all. The area that we're working, if you can pull that up, with Khartoum here and Port Sudan up here, is out here in Darfur. Takes 5 days to drive from there to Darfur, over trackless desert. And you just know where to go. Sometime they'll put a big 55-gallon empty now of oil, but filled with sand with a flag on it, and you just see the next one and you keep moving. So that's where we work, and you have to work through the government. You have to get permission to work out there. So to that degree, we have an agreement with the government that they let us import goods into Darfur, Sudan for eventual movement out here. And so we're out here. We also are looking, of course, with the Civil War, we've contributed, with the help of the U.S. government, $500,000 to move supply of food from Nairobi to Juba, J-U-B-A, which is surrounded by SPLA forces, Sudanese People Liberation Force. We also are flying food from Khartoum down to Juba. And we have a $625,000 water project in Sudan, southern Sudan. So we're doing, that's what we're doing. But the question is, should we be doing it? How much longer can we do it? Is it costing us too much? Other questions? Oh, are you serious?
Sure.
Should you be doing it or not?
A set of tires for a Land Rover will cost us $4,000. $1,000 a tire.
Why can't you bring in a set of tires?
Well, you can, but you have to get, that has to come in. Sure, you could do that, but sometimes you don't have the tires when you want them. What I'm relating, I guess, is not our inability to bring these things in, but the cost. And there are lots of things you can't bring in. Huh? You can bring it in, and we do bring it in cheaper than usual. I'm thinking of cement. We pack that in. That too is expensive, and particularly when you got to transport it 5 days. And fuel.
Well, then you're saying that the only thing maybe that we ought to be doing is flying in for food where they're starving.
Yeah. And that's what we're doing down here in Juba. We are also contemplating up here on the Nile River in a town called Kosti, looking at helping the UNHCR, United Nations High Commission for Refugees, to do some feeding in that particular post. Because people are moving from the south to the north, and that's one of the things we'll talk about, and that is the urbanization that's going on in Africa today. Other questions? Yes, Holly?
This is probably a really naive question, but are there any governments in these poor countries that aren't corrupt? I mean, that aren't... It seems like there are always these people at the high levels of government that are much more concerned with having their Mercedes and their rich palaces or whatever than they are concerned about their people. Is that true in every country? It's just really discouraging.
But Lenox.
You know where that is, way down in southern Africa.
That is a good country. They've turned over their government by voting now, I think, 2, 3, 4 times. Botswana is one that comes to mind quickly. I think Niger is another one. And there are others that I'm sure exist. Zimbabwe is one. Zimbabwe. I don't know how to spell it. E.
B-A-B-W-E.
Yeah. What, I'm missing something.
It's not giving me a W.
Well, Zimbabwe. That surely is one.
The Tanzania.
Tanzania might be one today. They've come along. I think Swaziland is one.
Because enlightened leaders have come forth, right?
Yes, I think so.
Not because of aid or whatever or so on. It's been the...
Well, I think there are lots of reasons. One, for example, Botswana is a rather well endowed with natural resources.
Okay.
Even though it's a very large country, it's had good leadership all the time. Tanzania, I think aid has been an important factor. I think the departure of Julius Nyerere, now as kind of president emeritus, has been a good thing for Tanzania. Zimbabwe with Robert Mugabe. I think he's an enlightened fellow. He's educated here in the United States. So yeah, there don't count them all as being bad.
But if the Sudan is an example, and that's all I was using as an example of a real trouble spot, poverty, corruption, and so on, what is the what's the formula? Pressure, wait it out, take out the aid. Well, encourage the people to overthrow the fat cats, or
come back to that.
Okay.
As we did yesterday.
Okay.
Education. I think that's one of the big things.
So we take food and schools then, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Would be useful.
How many of those leaders of those countries were educated in mission schools?
No, that's a good question. I don't know. Surely Julius Nyerere was, I know. Mugabe was educated at Harvard or somewhere out in the east. Botswana, under Sir Ratsikama, was educated in the UK. You get some. Any other questions on debt that you have? And I'm sorry that material didn't come, but I was planning on it, but I hope it will come now before the end of the week, and then I'll pass it to you. Otherwise, you can go out and jog or do what you will, okay? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.